Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
Eric Davis, high weirdness, drugs, esoterica, and visionary experience in the 70s. Really just, I mean, from my mind, Philip K. Dick is like, he's the Babe Ruth of the three heavy hitters you've mentioned so far as being
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the whole book started out as just being about Philip K. Dick. But I became interested in the way in which his remarkable experience that he called 2374, because it happened in 1974. It started in 1974. It resonated so much with these other experiences that I started to go, hey, something's going on that's more than just about Philip K. Dick and his very singular imagination and singular life. But he really is the person that I've been reading the longest and studied the most and have written the most about. So that is the heart of the tale.
Yeah, and I think you said singular, and it kind of rubs up against singularity, and I think that that's not out of the question in a conversation about what was going on with Philip K. Dick's mind, as he blended pretty seamlessly the fact of his life and the fictions that he was writing about.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about that blend between fact and fiction. It's on our minds so much these days as we try to just navigate consensus reality as it melts
right
down. And we look back at these guys, and they were really pushing that boundary. And Dick did it, in a different way than Wilson, but not too terribly different. Where even though he had this remarkable set of experiences that, you know, visionary dreams and synchronicities and experiences with light and getting downloading messages and, you know, all this kind of paranormal material, the closer you look at it, you realize that a lot of it is kind of like his own fiction, but it's not like he's making it up. It's like he's in a loop where like his own fictions are entering into his life. And then he's responding like a character in one of his stories. And he's acknowledging that his own works in some ways, you know, resemble reality more and more. And he's like, there's something going on here that's about, that's beyond the difference between fiction and reality.
Yeah. And I've never read 2374. I don't think it's been published in its entirety now, finally. Are there a thousand of the 8,000 pages, or how many pages have been published?
Yeah. So after he had this experience, he spent the rest of his life writing about it in different ways. He wrote novels based on it. Valis is the most famous and probably the most worthwhile. But he also wrote this private diary that he never intended to publish that he called the Exegesis. And it's this enormous work. And I worked on the published version of it, which, like you said, is a big, fat book, fatter than mine.
Come on.
It's only a tenth of what he wrote.
I heard it was 8,000 pages.
Something like that. That sounds about right.
And 8,000, and I'm not saying this to besmirch his good name, rest in peace, but 8,000 fairly drug-fueled pages, right? I mean, he was writing, like, feverishly 150 pages a week or day or something like that for a while.
He was writing feverishly, but the interesting thing about Dickens makes him different than Terence McKenna and Robert Anton Wilson is that those guys were really into psychedelics, and they were taking psychedelics big time to blow themselves to the ends of the universe. But Dick, especially by the early 1970s, wasn't actually taking that many drugs, and he never...
Wait. Yeah, psychedelics, I'm not saying. He was taking speed, though.
Right, but by the 70s, he was not really taking speed anymore, because that was the 60s. So that's what's interesting about him, is he's not actually... I mean, he's drug damaged, no doubt. And but the thing about Dick is that it's not just about the drugs, because he was always weird. Like when he was a kid, he had very strange experiences. They had him in, you know, seeing psychiatrists, and he was on meds, you know, at a very early point. So he is what we would say not neurotypical, you know. Right. The other guys were kind of bringing it on. They were like Prometheans. They wanted to push it to the edge. In a way, Dick brought it on, but he also kind of suffered it. He was more like a classic mystic that had things just sort of happen to him. And so he wrote like a maniac, but in a way he was almost outside of the really drug-fueled period that he had had earlier in his life.
Yeah, fair enough. And I'm not the expert, nor do I claim to be, but I do remember reading at one point, I don't know, maybe it was in the reviews when A Scanner Darkly came out as a movie, and people were talking about he had all these like hippies that were living in his big old house with him, right? He let street people live with him for a period of time.
He was living with the hippies, and his life was really spiraling out of control. He hit bottom, and then he went into a clinic, you know, like a rehab clinic. And after he got out of the rehab clinic, he moved to Southern California. And that's where, like, things kind of settled down, you know, comparatively.
Right. I
mean, still living on the edge. But the Exegesis is a fascinating, strange book. I mean, on one hand, it's just like a million crank pieces of literature out there where people write their metaphysics of the actual true structure of the cosmos, and they're just in some attic somewhere or, you know, in a basement somewhere. And in a way, it's like one of these like crazy texts, but it's also written by this brilliant science fiction writer. So it's much richer than that. And so it's a fascinating way to see what happens when people have really far out experiences, and then they try to write their way out of them. They try to understand what's happening, and they leave these texts behind that we can look at and go, whoa, what were they thinking?
Right.
Or what were they on? Or what had gone down with?
Yeah, that the word is interesting too. Exegesis coming from the Greek, and meaning very specifically in literature, how one allows the text to speak for itself. But in his case, I think the exegesis and this, you know, voluminous work, which we'll never hear the end of, we'll never probably see the end of it in our lifetimes, published. Was letting that period of his life, that 2-3-74 period of his life, speak for itself.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about the Dick's whole situation is that he felt like he had gotten a revelation, like in the full religious sense, like he had seen through the falseness of reality and seen and glimpsed the truth. But at the same time, it's like he didn't really get the message. Like he didn't really know what it meant. He didn't really know what the revelation was about. And so what you see in the exegesis is he offers theory after theory after theory after theory. I mean, he's like, you know, the wildest speculators that you have on the show turned up to 11 over and over and over and over again, like night after night, year after year. Maybe it was a Soviet satellite beaming signals to my head. Maybe the universe is one God. Maybe there are two gods and they're fighting. Maybe it's one side of my brain and the other side of the brain. It's just like
right.
theory after theory after theory. But he had this like revelatory experience, so he knew it was really important. So in a way, he was in a very challenging bind.
Yeah,
you know, trying to think his way out, to exegete, to interpret, or to let the text of his own experience speak. But the thing is that the text was garbled.
Right.
Like it was full of noise and multiple meanings, and he could never really figure it out. So it's a remarkable, it's sort of like a postmodern religious
oh, yeah.
experience.
You know, oh,
like
yeah.
religious experiences in the old days, people have the revelation and they come out and they go, I know. You know,
right.
we must all sit around in a circle and stare at each other's eyes and God will come down. And then everybody follows them or doesn't.
Right.
But with
right.
Dick, he had this revelation, but it's like he never really got anything except the profound sense that the world as we know it is an illusion.
Except, I don't know, and again, you're the expert here. We're talking about high weirdness, Eric Davis, in this particular period of literature and art in the late 60s, early 70s, particularly the early 70s, which leads to some, I think, you know, it's the blueprint for a lot of things which turn out all the time on Coast to Coast. But there was a level of particular, I thought, sort of a Christian experience that Philip K. Dick had during that time. Is that not right? Where he...
Oh, there's definitely a big theme of... I mean, he actually became a Christian in the
right.
early 1960s. And even though from the outside you might look at his life and work and go, oh, it doesn't seem that Christian. A little bit. But he would always say, no, I'm an Episcopalian. I'm Episcopalian. I'm a Christian.
Right.
And so, yeah, his 2374 is full of Christian stuff. But it's also as Buddhist stuff and Taoist stuff and Greek
right.
stuff, Gnostic stuff up the wazoo. But a lot of it is Christian. I mean, he definitely was focused on the figure of the Christ. He was very into
right.
the idea of the Logos, the idea that the kind of God's sort of information enters into our
right.
false world and begins to transform and even redeem it. And he
yeah.
was interested in the idea that there would be another kind of savior figure. So even though he wouldn't be recognized as a conventional Christian by most Christians, there's definitely an important Christian layer. And that's actually one of the arguments that I have, is that nobody thinks of him as a Christian writer. You know, there's a lot of writers out there that, Walker Percy or somebody, and like, oh, well,
right.
he's a Christian author. And Dick was he always insisted he was a Christian. There's Christian motifs in his book, but people never think about him as like a Christian science fiction writer or something. But in some ways you have to recognize that as a crucial part.
And I think actually you hit on it in a way. And this I can speak from, because I'm ordained in the Episcopal Church. He's got a very Episcopal outlook. And so even when you mention things like, you know, Taoism and other tradition, Buddhism and stuff, that too becomes part of a regular conversation. It's not the core of the faith by all means, but there are things that happen within the Episcopal tradition because it tends to be much more open-minded maybe than other Christian
denominations.
Oh yeah,
and another, I think another important element of his Christianity that will be, reminds us of how, different periods of Christian history have had different effects, is that he really glommed on to the early period,
right.
not just because, you're closer to Christ, Christ is going to come again, but he one of his ideas was that the whole period of time between, Rome and our current moment was an illusion, and that we were basically actually living in expecting the imminent return of Christ in the Roman period. And that, as he put it, Rome never died, and that we were still kind of living in this period of time.
In the time of crypto-Christianity, when Christians were still hiding in tombs.
Exactly, and that's what he really identified with, was the idea
yeah.
that that as spiritual people, as people who had seen the light, as people who were struggling for the good, we're underground. The dominant world is dark. It's controlled. It's a black iron prison. And so now, you know, we're in different countries in different ways. You know, Christianity has more or less power depending on, you know, it depends on the situation. But we don't tend to think of it as this underground rebel, you know, like the rebels in the first Star Wars movie. And that's right. What he's really relating with is that right. Aspect of Christianity, which is for me has always been the most attractive part of Christianity.
Yeah. Through a scanner Darthly. It might be where the Rebel Alliance taking on the, and I think that's interesting because you mentioned that where two hemispheres of his brain seem to always be in competition with each other. And that was another internal struggle. I don't know whether that was the result of the previous psychedelic drug use or whether it was some residue of a psychotic break at some point. But I mean, that's part of that Philip K. Dick, at least the legend of Philip K. Dick that I find so interesting is his mind was at war with itself.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Sometimes he felt that there was another person inside of him.
Okay.
It was usually good. Like it was usually someone who was on his side. So it wasn't too conflictual, but you know, I mean, he definitely, you know, veered into something like psychosis or whatever you want to call it, bipolar, this and that. I mean, he was, as I said, he was non-neurotypical. And yeah. One of the things that you can, you know, so you could look at his life and read his books and go, wow, this guy's pretty crazy. But another way is to say, well, maybe he was even crazier than that. And he did all this to keep himself as sane as he could. And by telling these stories and by pursuing spirituality and researching, you know, the history of myth and the history of religion and trying to figure out what was going on, he was actually like weaving himself back together. And so it's a really powerful way of recognizing some of the really important relationships between religion or esoteric mystical experience and psychopathology. They're not the same thing. But their intention, and in some people in particular, it's a serious tension. And you know, we find if you look at the lives of mystics, or if you look at the most spiritually powerful people you've known, some of them live very upright lives, but some of them live pretty crazy lives because they spend some time being kind of crazy. So there's something about that light that also brings you closer to pathology, and that's one of the things that I'm really interested in with all these guys.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s. Dance away with hip-hop beats and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.